Emily Johnston, you co-founded 350.org in Seattle, Washington. As we wrap up, your thoughts on what your plans are now that you are acquitted?
Well, in the immediate sense, you know, we are engaged in many climate campaigns in Seattle and in Washington State. There's plenty of work to be done. I'm looking forward to getting back to it. Great majority of that work is legal, but we do engage in some civil disobedience actions. And, you know, we really, with this trial, we particularly wanted to do the necessity defense. This would have been sort of the dream trial in terms of our expert witnesses and our ability to present that defense. The fact that we couldn't do that is pretty heartbreaking. And so I know a lot of people are still thinking about
We're going to have to end it there, but we'll do part two and post online at democracynow.org and at Klopstein and Emily Johnston, Kelsey Skaggs, and Dr. James Hansen. Thanks so much. I'll be speaking in Florida next weekend as well as Washington tomorrow night. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Save the Village, an open house for community in action on Sunday, October 14th from 2 to 5 p.m. at Foster Village in Portland. Save the Village is an open house of Foster Village which features tours, information of the skills and best practices of community living, live music, food, and celebration. There will also be the opportunity to learn more about the expansion of Foster Village through the purchase of the Orange House. Again, that's Save the Village, an open house for community in action on Sunday, October 14th from 2 to 5 p.m. at Foster Village, 4635 Southeast 64th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Women's Reproductive Rights Now on Sunday, October 14th from 3 to 6 p.m. at Sunnyside Community House, located at 3520 Southeast Yamhill Street in Portland. Women's Reproductive Rights Now is an educational event to support activists fighting for reproductive rights. Speakers include Judith Arcana, Dr. Patricia Kohlberg, Reverend Emily Champagne, and Sally Castillo of Planned Parenthood. There will also be videos, tabling, food, and more. Again, that's Women's Reproductive Rights Now on Sunday, October 14th from 3 to 6 p.m. at the Sunnyside Community House in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's a couple minutes past 5, and coming up next, we have KBOO Evening News. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Portland 5 Centers for Arts, presenting the Soweto Gospel Choir Wednesday, October 17th at Arlene Schnitzer Hall, honoring Nelson Mandela's 100th birthday. More information online at portland5.com. That's portland5.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland police kill a second civilian in as many weeks, this time in the Lentz neighborhood.
Hurricane Michael has made landfall on the Florida Panhandle and is gaining strength as it pushes inland.
And in international news, the Turkish government says that the order to kill a Washington Post columnist at the Saudi embassy in Istanbul came from the highest levels of the Saudi government.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 10th, 2018. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. Police shot and killed a civilian in Southeast Portland Wednesday morning in a standoff that involved SWAT team officers. The incident occurred near the Del Rancho Motel, near the intersection of 82nd Avenue and Flavelle. Officers responded to reports of two men fighting near the motel, said Sergeant Chris Burley, during an afternoon news conference. When they arrived, they learned that the person who had entered a room at the Del Rancho was holding a woman hostage, said Burley. The Special Emergency Reaction Team and Crisis Negotiation Team were called to the scene, said the officers. Burley said that as the teams were setting up, an officer took a shot and killed the civilian. This has been the 33rd police shooting incident in Oregon this year and the 18th ending in death. It is also the second fatal shooting by police in Portland in the past 2 weeks. Police Chief Danielle Outlaw and Mayor Ted Wheeler were both on the scene this morning and afternoon. The investigation by PPB homicide detectives, the East County Major Crimes Team, and the District Attorney's Office is ongoing.
Portland buildings are very vulnerable to collapse in an earthquake, especially the major earthquake in the Cascadia subduction zone that will likely hit in the next coming decades. The City Council on Wednesday approved a policy that would require owners of brick and similar buildings to prominently post signs with the disclosure reading, quote, "This is an unreinforced masonry building. Unreinforced masonry buildings may be unsafe in the event of a major earthquake," unquote. The same warning will be distributed to tenants of the buildings. Oregon Live reported the city has more than 1,600 unreinforced masonry buildings that have been around for almost 90 years. These buildings will most likely not do well in an earthquake. The warnings are intended as an interim measure. The city won't require building owners to make fixes to prevent collapse for at least 20 years, and city councilors agreed and approved the warnings, said that they would allow residents and customers to weigh the risk for themselves. Some businesses are saying it may scare away customers, making it harder to afford fixing the building in the long run. The signs will publicly go up by January 1st. The ordinance was approved in a 3-0 vote.
This Sunday, former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak will be in Portland to speak at the Middleman Jewish Community Center. A coalition of local activists and human rights groups will be showing up also to protest the presence of Barak in Portland. Occupation Free Portland includes members of the Democratic Socialist Party and Jewish Voice for Peace. KBOO reporter Leila Kanan spoke with Mohammed Nabil, a Palestinian activist in Portland, to find out more about why the group is protesting Barak.
Joining us today, we have Mohammed Nabil, a Portland-based Palestinian activist from Gaza. He will be discussing the upcoming visit of former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, who is coming to the Middleman Center in Portland on Sunday. Mohammed, how are Portlanders planning to respond to this visit?
So we are here in Portland, multiple organizations come together to organize a protest for his visit. And there is an event on Facebook called War Criminals Are Not Welcome Here. And that will be on Sunday at 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. And it will be held in the Middleton Jewish Community Center. And the organizations are Jewish Voice for Peace and some organizations who are under the Occupation Free Portland and some other organizations that are involved in the Palestine solidarity scene here in Portland. So the main idea that we are here is, as like our event includes, that we are not welcoming war criminals here. And Ehud Olmert, he was like... Ehud Olmert was like the prime minister in the Operation Kaslid in 2008, that Ehud Barak was the Israeli Defense Force who basically led and orchestrated that operation. I was in Gaza at that time, and I still remember the first bomb, which basically killed more than 180 people in the first hour. I still remember it was at noon. I was going home from my school and suddenly the ground has been shaken under me. Basically, in that operation, more than 1,200 Palestinians have been killed. More than 5,000 people have been injured. And that operation, mind you, it was like only 8 days. Mm-hmm. Most of the people in Gaza have been either have somebody who got injured, have somebody who got killed, have their houses being partially or completely demolished. All of the businesses have been affected, and also not even the animals have been spared from that type of obliteration, basically. And here in Portland, we are not just protesting Ehud because he's a bad guy or the only bad guy in Israel. Frankly, we are protesting him because he's a representation of the State of Israel policies against the Palestinian people. not just in Gaza, but also in the West Bank and inside Israel. The Palestinian people who live in Israel, there's 20% of Palestinian people live in Israel right now. And also the Israeli state against the Palestinian people in the diaspora and preventing them from entering their homeland and visiting their people and their homes. So this is a protest. This is a sign to say, like, war criminals are not welcomed here. And we are here to say no and raise our voices, because what else we can do? We need to basically stand up for this type of war crimes. We need to tell the Jewish Federation no. We need to tell the state of Israel no, and we need to spread the word. And I encourage every listener here to come out on Sunday and join us by saying no to war crimes, no to ethnic cleansing, no to systematic oppression, no to apartheid wall, no to borders. We are here also representing the voices of the Palestinian people by saying we are here.
Mm-hmm. Right. Making sure that their voices are heard.
Yes.
Yeah. So just to wrap up, can you tell us where people can find out more? Where can they look?
So if you go to Facebook, you can type war criminals not welcome here. You will find the event page. And here I want to mention a security thing. The event is public, so you can read the information and come and join us there if you don't want your name to be tracked. Also, bring visible signs, bring Palestinian flags, and also bring your friends, because we need the numbers, because we are stronger together. We are stronger when we have our voices here.
Of course. And so just one more time, can you give us the when and the where of the protest in case people want to join?
Sunday at 6 p.m. It's at the Middleton Jewish Community Center at 6651 Southwest Capitol Way.
Great. Thank you so much, Mohammed.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. That was Mohammed Nabil speaking with us about the upcoming Ahud Barak visit and the protests that will follow. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Leila Kanaan.
And now we have a roundup of national stories from the Public News Service, a newswire in the public interest with bureaus in 36 states. Today we'll hear from Florida, already dealing with the consequences of Hurricane Michael before it landed this morning. We'll also hear how health care will play into the upcoming elections and part 3 of a series on opioids and addiction from the Ohio News Service.
October the 10th, 2018, I'm Mike Clifford. Hurricane Michael expected to be a Cat 4 when it strikes the Florida Panhandle later today. Also on the Wednesday Rundown, our series on addiction and crime continues today, the cycle of addiction. Plus, Catholic nuns bring a message of economic justice to Arizona. First, our top story, Hurricane Michael has intensified to a Category 3 major hurricane and is forecast to strengthen to a Category 4 before making landfall on the Florida Panhandle Gulf Coast later today. With life-threatening storm surge, flooding, destructive winds, and flooding rainfall. The Weather Channel adds, Michael will also spread heavy rain and strong winds to other parts of the southeastern U.S. after it moves inland. A potentially catastrophic event is developing, according to the National Weather Service in Tallahassee. They forecast that locations may be uninhabitable for weeks or months. Meantime, Florida's red tide bloom continues to be a drag on tourism, causing fish kills and inducing respiratory problems for beachgoers. It's uncertain whether Hurricane Michael will help or make the problem worse.
NOAA researchers say no past hurricane has ever managed to break up a red tide outbreak, but the cases where blooms and hurricanes occur at the same time are rare. David Hastings, a marine and chemistry professor at Eckerd College, says one possibility is the storm could push the blooms farther out to sea. But he says the hurricane could also feed the red tide and exacerbate the problem by bringing more nutrients to the surface.
The heavy rains will drain farms, agricultural areas, septic tanks, and make more nutrients go into the water.
In 2004 and 2005, four hurricanes clobbered the state, and scientists suspect that triggered one of the worst red tide outbreaks in Florida history, killing fish and shutting down beaches for more than a year. I'm Tramell Gomes.
And as America's political divide sharpens, Roz Brown tells us one issue most agree will be important at the ballot box next month is health care.
In a CBS News poll conducted last month, 70% of Americans said they think health care is very important, more so than any other top issue. Robert Blendon, a professor of public health and politics at Harvard University, says some voters are convinced that if Republicans retain their majority in Congress, they could try again to repeal the Affordable Care Act or make it harder for people with pre-existing conditions to get insurance.
When you look at all the polls, you ask people which party, people who are registered to vote, do they see as better in health care? The Democrats have a very far lead on this issue.
South Dakota is one of 17 states that did not elect to expand Medicaid, although next month, three more states will vote on expansion, Idaho, Nebraska, and Utah.
And now Mary Sherman presents part three of her series of reports on addiction and crime. Today, the cycle of addiction.
Mitzi Stoddard of East Liverpool spent time in and out of prison for a decade while she struggled with addiction and eventually got clean when her family got her into rehab. Stoddard explained sobriety achieved behind bars won't stick upon release unless people have the appropriate treatment.
You go there and then you feel worse about yourself, and then you have this label that you are a criminal and an addict and you're this bad person, and you get out and more people don't want anything to do with you. And your way of coping as an addict is to use because it makes that feeling go away.
Reverend Susan Smith of Columbus says she's seen the vicious cycle of addiction in prison in her community.
I'll never forget this one guy came in the middle of the night and he was sobbing. He was sobbing. He said, Reverend Susan, I just can't do this. And he said, I don't understand why I can't beat.
Issue 1 would reclassify nonviolent drug possession as a misdemeanor. This story was produced in association with Media in the Public Interest and funded in part by the George Gunn Foundation.
Security officers in Pittsburgh celebrating a new contract that for many almost doubles the pay and benefits they were getting just a few years ago.
The agreement was announced in Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto's conference room on Tuesday. It covers more than 1,100 workers who protect most of the city's iconic buildings, museums, and universities. According to Sam Williamson with Local 32BJ of the Service Employees International Union, just 3 years ago, when they negotiated their first contract, some of these workers were making $8.50 an hour and had no employer-funded health insurance. Now, their jobs include insurance, and they're moving toward a living wage.
Raised the base or starting pay to $14.20 an hour over the course of the contract, and the average pay will be a little over $15 an hour by the end of the agreement.
He says those raises will bring an additional $7 million over 4 years into low-income households and neighborhoods across Pittsburgh. I'm Andrea Sears reporting.
Finally, Catherine Davis-Young reports election season's in high gear in Arizona, and amid messaging from candidates and political action committees, a new group joins the political conversation in the state this week, Catholic Nuns.
The Nuns on the Bus tour is driving cross-country to share a message of economic justice. A handful of Catholic sisters from orders around the country visit Phoenix and Tucson today and tomorrow. The group's leader, Sister Simone Campbell, says her faith teaches her to look out for society's most vulnerable people. And in her view, politics is an important piece of that.
Quite frankly, the Constitution's best values are quite similar to my faith values. And what we know is it's about we the people.
The politically active Catholic sisters will visit 21 states on their tour. I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for newsin' and cruisin' with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
With sustained wind speeds of up to 155 miles per hour and flooding in areas still devastated from recent storms, Hurricane Michael made landfall today along the coast of the Florida Panhandle near Mexico Beach east of Panama City, the worst recorded storm to hit Florida in the last 100 years and the largest storm in terms of wind to hit the United States since 2004. Michael will cut a path through the Florida Panhandle across Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina. Winds are expected to be buffeting eastern Virginia as Michael continues into the Atlantic Ocean off the eastern coast of the United States.
Even as Hurricane Michael promises to inundate the eastern seaboard, residents in parts of North Carolina continue to struggle with the aftermath of Hurricane Florence last month. KBOO reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu spoke yesterday with Vanessa Bolin, a community organizer and indigenous artist and activist who is currently in Lumberton, a city of 21,000 people in Robeson County, North Carolina, with the group Mutual Aid Disaster Response.
So Mutual Aid and Disaster Relief and Project Hope, which Project Hope are local community leaders who have a nonprofit. Mutual Aid Disaster Relief is a larger entity of a nonprofit. And what we are doing is providing support and food and water and cleaning supplies to those who are affected in Robeson County, which is the Lumberton and the Lumbee Nation territory. We've been helping since before the flood, and during the flood we did rescue via boat and just driving into the waters to get people out. And after the flood happened, we started focusing on getting food and water and supplies, cleaning supplies. That's what we're doing right now.
So what have you seen and heard on the ground there?
Well, during the flood, there were a lot of people who did not evacuate. They had areas that had never flooded before that ended up flooding, and we're talking some water levels that were to roofs, and then communities in areas that had never flooded saw water that came into their homes, damaged a lot of roof from the wind. This is the largest county in North Carolina. It's also the poorest county in North Carolina. It's 65% indigenous, people of color, Hispanic, and other. And it is the poorest county. So what has happened here is people paid attention to the hurricane. They watched it, the flooding happened, and then it was crickets. No media presence, nothing. People's homes are still flooded. There's still standing water underneath people's crawl spaces, in their basements. There's roofs that are just destroyed. Water is still coming in. There's another hurricane on the way. We are going to get some rainfall here that's going to inundate the already saturated ground. People are worried about flooding. And the problem is that supplies into this marginalized, poor community have slowed to a trickle. There are people who still are bringing stuff in. It's just not enough. Also have seen the county did finally declare it disaster area. So they put out that people could get emergency food stamps. And why I keep talking about this being the poorest county, most of the people who do have jobs here work in the service industry, be it at a restaurant or at a convenience store or at a dollar store or something like that. Well, when these businesses started opening back up, they told people, you have to get to work. Now, remember, people's homes are flooded. All the shelters started closing. People were going back to moldy homes, trying to get them a safe place to live. But these businesses are saying, come back in or you have to work. The county started doing emergency food stamps. But what they did was gave people 8 days. And they had to come in person to the county office and fill out the paperwork. And then they're making them wait up to 30 days. Now, remember, supplies have slowed to a trickle. Where we had stuff where we could get food and water and cleaning supplies and diapers and formula into people's hands has dried up. Like, it's just not happening on a big enough scale. The county has now closed the registration. That 8-day period to apply for emergency food stamps has closed. And there are many, many thousands of people in this community who had to go back to work, whose homes are still flooded, whose cars were destroyed, who had no way to get there. And the county has effectively shut them off.
Organizer Vanessa Bolin, working with the group Mutual Aid Disaster Relief, speaking from North Carolina with KBOO reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu yesterday afternoon. You can hear the full version of that interview tomorrow on KBOO Evening News In-Depth at 5:45.
If you want to eat a roadkill deer or elk in Oregon, it will be legal beginning January 1st, but there are rules. Among the restrictions are filling out online forms from Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife within 24 hours and turning in the head and antlers to an ODFW within 5 days. Animals can only be salvaged to be eaten, the meat cannot be sold, and the carcass must be removed from the road. If the animal is struck but not killed and then put down to end its suffering, only the driver who hit it can have it. It will still be illegal to intentionally kill a deer or elk with a vehicle in order to salvage it.
And KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is roaring back from Kavanaugh gloom.
When you get knocked down, jump back up. The darker the sky, the greater the need for flames. The colder the days, the closer together we'll work. The longer the nights, the better our concealment. Since the government lies all the time, little analysis is needed to find out what the Repugs are planning, see what they're accusing the Democrats of. This isn't news. They control all three branches of the government they're dismantling. All the money, hence power, is in a few pockets who never hear us. You think if the Democrats control the House, they'll risk their spot at the billionaire corporate trough? There's so much needs changing, so many slow-moving institutions in our way. Our only choice is doing the impossible. Total commitment, patience, and wide open hearts in these ever more dangerous times. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the Boo. At 6, it's Right to Survive, then at 7, it's Combined Culture Radio. Tonight's weather is clear with a low of 47. Tomorrow will be clear with a high of 69 and no rain expected for the next week. Today in history, in 1973, Spiro Agnew became the first U.S. vice president to resign in disgrace, pleading no contest to federal tax evasion charges. The quote of the day is also from Spiro, who was once described as only opening his mouth to exchange feet. In the United States today, we have more than our share of the nattering nabobs of negativism.
They still be there by the cut. There was a ragged band that followed in our footsteps, running before time.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Hopworks Urban Brewery, offering sustainable brews and local food for 10 years, serving the community at three locations: Hopworks Urban Brewery on Southeast Powell Boulevard, Bike Bar at North Williams Avenue, and in Vancouver at Southeast Mill Plain Boulevard. More information online at hopworksbeer.com.
Black History 365 is a daily segment produced at the studios of KPFT Houston. Today, they take a look at an innovator in the history of one of Portland's favorite ways to get around.
Black history is happening every day. It's time to start thinking of it outside of a day or a week or a month. We hope to inspire you by enlightening you with those people and events that should be learned from and forever remembered.
Today is October 10th. On this day in 1899, African-American inventor Isaac R. Johnson patented a folding type of bicycle frame. Johnson's frame could be taken apart for convenient storage when not in use. Though Johnson did not invent the bicycle, he is celebrated for his innovative approach to expanding the functionality of this modern method of mobility.
Achievements and events are not confined to the past. Make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365, BAM 365, where you find every day Black history is made.
Last week, California's Democratic governor vetoed a bill that would have allowed San Francisco to open a supervised injection site, or SIS. SISs operate in a quote-unquote harm reduction framework. They provide clean injection equipment, basic drug and healthcare information, access to medical staff, and referrals to services. Governor Jerry Brown's decision came soon after an op-ed in the New York Times by Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, which declared that the U.S. government still considers SISs as firmly illegal. Proponents of the facilities in cities across the United States, including here in Portland, point to the recent successes of places like Insite, spelled I-N-S-I-T-E, located in Vancouver, Canada, which is the first such facility in North America. For more, we turn to Dean Becker, host of KPFT Houston's 420 Drug War News.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Governor Brown in California,
Jerry Brown, he vetoed Assembly Bill 186, which would have allowed San Francisco to open a overdose prevention service that would let drug users use controlled substances under the supervision of staff trained to treat and even prevent drug overdose, and it would link people to drug treatment, housing, and other services. The bill was authored by Assemblymember Susan Talamantes Eggman, and it passed the California Assembly and Senate earlier this year. Quote, "I am shocked that the governor turned his back on the science and the experts and instead used outdated drug war ideology to justify his veto," end quote. So said Laura Thomas, the interim state director of the Drug Policy Alliance. Quote, "He cited long disproven ideas about substance use in his veto message rationale. It's disturbing that Governor Brown apparently believes these myths about the need for coercive treatment, and even more disturbing that people will die because of his veto. Drug overdose is the leading cause of accidental death in California. How many people have to die before Governor Brown is willing to listen to the science and evidence and experience? How many families have to lose a loved one?" End quote. The negative health and social consequences of drug use remain staggeringly high in California. Despite strong investment in treatment and prevention, drug overdose is now the leading cause of accidental death in California and nationwide, killing more people than motor vehicle accidents, and is the leading cause of death for people under 50 in the U.S. Public drug injection is associated with higher rates of overdose, transmission of infectious diseases, including HIV and viral hepatitis, as well as a variety of nuisance and safety issues. The safe consumption site in Vancouver, Insite, reduced fatal drug overdoses in the area around it by one-third. It also dramatically reduced public drug injection in the area and syringe litter. The bill was sponsored by the Drug Policy Alliance, California Association of Alcohol and Drug Program Executives, California Society of Addiction Medicine, Harm Reduction Coalition, Project Inform, and Tarzana Treatment Center. Overdose prevention services, or supervised consumption services, are proven harm reduction services that are effective at linking people who use drugs to treatment and other services, reducing overdose deaths. There is broad support in San Francisco for opening these programs. The mayor and board of supervisors, plus the elected law enforcement officers, the sheriff, and the district attorneys, supported AB 186. I'm Dean at DrugTruth.net.
In yet another largely unreported move by Congress, Kevin McCarthy of California's 23rd Congressional District has announced plans to introduce the so-called Build the Wall, Enforce the Law Act in Congress this week. This bill, like others in a series of bills already passed by Congress, deals primarily with immigration. The Build the Wall, Enforce the Law Act seeks to fully fund the border wall, as well as requiring enforcement of federal immigration laws. The bill is expected to request $23.4 billion in order to fully fund the border wall project, as well as seeking enforcement of Cates Law, which passed the House last year. Also expected will be enforcement measures for the No Sanctuary for Criminals Act and the Criminal Alien Gang Member Removal Act, both of which passed the House last year. Also likely covered in the new bill are two House resolutions on immigration that passed the House this year, one upholding and honoring Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, officers, the other admonishing illegal alien voting in a number of American cities. It seems as good a time as any to remind Oregonians that the deadline to register to vote is October 16th.
Is that Oregon wine you're about to buy actually from Oregon? If the wine is from Copper Cane Wine and Provisions, it may not be. Oregon's two senators and four of our congressional representatives sent a letter to the Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau requesting an investigation. The letter contains concerns brought by Oregon winemakers and the Oregon Wine Growers Association to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission on September 21st. Copper cane uses some grapes from Oregon, but federal law requires 75% of the grapes in a wine to be from the area for that name to appear on the label. Recently, Copper cane canceled contracts for 2,000 tons of wine grapes from several southern Oregon growers, allegedly due to smoke taint, though most of the grapes have been shown in tests to be uncontaminated.
As the Air Force drone pilot watched his computer screen, this message appeared. Insert two quarters to continue. This is just one of many incidents in a new report from the U.S. Government Accounting Office showing how easy it was to hack U.S. weapons systems. GAO test teams, quote, easily took over real systems without detection, using relatively simple tools and techniques, exposing, quote, basic issues like poor password management and unencrypted communications, unquote. Testers found that, quote, multiple weapon systems used commercial or open source software, but did not change the default password when the software was installed, allowing test teams to look up the password on the internet, end quote. Because of security and classification concerns, the GAO report does not name specific systems, but states the problems are more widespread than they could report because of restricted access. Concerns about Defense Department system vulnerabilities go back to 1991.
Three climate defenders on trial in Minnesota for shutting down a tar sands pipeline have been banned last week from presenting their planned defense. But today, Judge Robert Tiffany threw out the felony charges against them, saying the prosecution had failed to demonstrate any evidence of damage to the two Enbridge pipelines. The two valve turners, Annette Clapstein and Emily Johnston, and their support person Ben Joldersman, had planned to present a quote-unquote necessity defense, arguing their civil disobedience, coordinated with three activists in three other states, was necessary because of the imminent threat that fossil fuels pose to the planet and its inhabitants. The defendants had hoped, through the testimony of several expert witnesses, including former NASA scientist Dr. James Hansen, to inform the public about the injustice of climate change. Defendants in the other trials were not allowed to use the necessity defense either.
Now we turn to National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native news, views, and culture, produced by Native Voice One. Today's segment begins with the news that cultural artifacts from American tribes are turning up in auctions across the globe.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. At least three upcoming auctions in November, two in France and one in New Jersey, list sacred items, which tribes say should not be put up for sale. From KJZZ's Fronteras Desk, Laurel Morales reports.
Hopi and other tribal leaders say the commercialization of cultural heritage violates tribal laws. When human remains and sacred objects wind up on the auction block, they say it's often the result of looting and illegal trafficking. Eldred Licensi is a cultural sovereignty fellow at the Association of American Indian Affairs, a nonprofit that advocates for tribes.
These items are part of living cultures. Indigenous peoples are still here. We still practice on a daily basis these cultures, our languages, and our traditions. And these are simply just a part of us as our identity. And that's where we draw our strength.
The association is calling on collectors and auction houses to work with tribes to help them find a way to bring their artifacts and ceremonial items back home. For National Native News, I'm Laura Morales in Flagstaff.
The Cherokee Nation, one of the defendants in an Indian child welfare case along with the federal government, believes the recent court ruling poses a threat to sovereignty after a federal judge in Texas ruled the Indian Child Welfare Act is unconstitutional. The decades-old law aims to keep Native children with Native families. As Caroline Halter reports, the Oklahoma tribe is now considering next steps in the case.
The Texas judge wrote that the Indian Child Welfare Act is a race-based law, making it unconstitutional. But the ruling is an outlier, according to Cherokee Nation's Deputy Attorney General Chrissy Ross Nemo.
There's a long line of federal court decisions that say when you have a law that applies specifically to Indian people or Indian tribes, it's not because they're racially Indian, it's because they are members of a sovereign government.
Cherokee Nation plans to appeal the ruling, but a loss could send the case to the Supreme Court, and Nemo fears the consequences could be far-reaching.
This calls into question other areas of Indian law outside of the Indian Child Welfare Act.
Even if the case doesn't go to the Supreme Court, Nemo says losing the appeal could strengthen race-based arguments against Indian law in lower courts. For National Native News, I'm Caroline Halter.
The Cherokee Nation is among tribes which have long fought to keep protections under the Indian Child Welfare Act. The law was highlighted in the case known as Baby Veronica, in a custody battle between a Cherokee Nation citizen, the biological father, and an adoptive South Carolina couple. The Cherokee Nation fought to keep the child with the father, but she was eventually handed over to the couple. Tribes, advocates, and Native organizations closely followed that case, raising concerns about impacts in Indian country. Volunteers are helping the Tohono O'odham Nation in Arizona with recovery efforts after Tropical Storm Rosa caused flooding. According to the tribe's Emergency Management Department, cleanup efforts for homes impacted by the storm are continuing this week. Officials have also been watching a dam, which volunteers have assisted with by filling and placing sandbags in the area. Water is also being pumped out of the dam. Assessments are being made on houses and roads in the community. Parts of the Southwest saw record rain from the recent storm. This week, members of the Native American community in L.A. County gathered in San Fernando to call on the city to change the street named McClay. Native people say the man it's named after, California State Senator Charles McClay, committed atrocities against Native people in the 1800s. The Los Angeles Daily News reports local tribal members would like it replaced with the name of tribal leader Rogero Rocha. City leaders say they're open to discussions about changing the name as Native people plan to take it to the city council. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Quantic Broadcast Corporation.
The Saudi-born Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi has been missing for over a week, with reports strongly indicating he was murdered last week by a hit team sent by the government of Saudi Arabia while inside the country's consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Those reports are primarily coming from the Turkish government, which announced yesterday that its security apparatus believes the order to kill Khashoggi came from the, quote, highest levels of the Saudi government. Critics from across the political spectrum say the Trump administration still has not used its close ties to the ruling royal family, and especially with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, commonly known as MBS, to get anywhere nearer to the truth of what happened to Khashoggi or to challenge the Saudis over the possible assassination of a U.S. resident and journalist.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 10th, 2018. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Lucas Campbell, Dan Raphael, Jenka Soderberg, Layla Kanan, Yasmin Kobanoglu, and Ethan Rogers. Special thanks to Native Voice One, Public News Service, and KPFT Houston. The producer is Sam Bowman, and our engineer is David Kesters. The interim directors of Evening News and Public Affairs are Sam Bowman and Teresa Mitchell. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Native Voices from the Edge with Carrie and Amory. At 9, Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Between the Covers, and at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
Hello, folks, and welcome to News from the Boo. This is your weekly update about what is going on in and around KBOO. I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and how to say this? Becky Myers is leaving. And it's tough. It's tough. It's great. It's beautiful, but it's tough for me. So I wanted to do your exit interview for News from the Boo because I think I think this is the thing that I love the most about you is how much I've learned, you know, interacting with you. I've learned so much about, you know, development, of course, because this has been our relationship, but I've also learned about being a leader and, you know, and being in this radio world. And, you know, and also like learn about the meaning of KBOO and why it is even, yeah, and not that I didn't know before why it was so important to keep it going, but you helped me see, you know, different depth to radio, to the radio world and to the community radio world and to community radio in particular. So my first question for you is, Becky, what have you learned at KBOO? That's a hard question. It's a long question because it's been like almost 4 years of you working at KBOO. Mm-hmm.
I have learned, I think, a lot about myself first and foremost. I came into KBOO, I think, totally willing and wanting to collaborate with people and work together. It's a community radio station, so being a part of a community was something I was really open and interested in, but I, you know, frankly, didn't really know how to be a part of the community very well. Being at KBOO has given me the opportunity to learn about what it means to communicate with others in a healthy way, how to, you know, be present in places that are sometimes really uncomfortable.